Hello, everyone. This is Bonfire Madigan. We're not crazy. The system is. Tune into the Radical Mental Health Show, hosted by the Freedom Center, Wednesday nights, 6 to 7 p.m. on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ 103.3 FM.
And this is the Mental Health Show on Valley Free Radio. I'm Will Hall. I'm your host. I'm actually in the studio all by my lonesome this evening. And we're going to be having a guest interview with a guest who's calling in from California in a few minutes after we do some announcements. Delphine Brody, who is an advocate doing regional and statewide as well as some national organizing around mental health, civil rights issues. We're going to be talking about that. But first, I just want to introduce the show. This is sponsored by the Freedom Center, which is a local support, activist, and advocacy organization run by and for people who are labeled with mental illnesses, diagnoses like bipolar, schizophrenia, depression, borderline. And we're working together to protect our rights, our civil and human rights, and also to create alternatives to the mainstream system. A lot of people have not had good experiences with mainstream treatments, with the mainstream hospital scene, with the use of force and coercion. A lot of us feel like we've been abused and violated by the mental health system, so we're working for alternatives. And you can check out our website, which is freedom-center.org. A lot of the work that we do is around education, around medication, and the different alternatives and options that people have, the risks that psychiatric drugs have, but also respecting people's choice to take them or not take them, depending on what they want to do. We're very strongly opposed to the use of force by the mental health system, which even in Northampton, at Cooley Dickinson Hospital, the local mental health system, people are being forced to take psychiatric drugs against their will, against their religious beliefs. It is happening throughout the country and continues. That's something we're very concerned about. So you can check out our website, which is freedom-center.org. We do activism work, we do education work, we also provide alternative wellness services. So we have Delphine Brody on the line. Delphine is a consumer survivor activist from California, is giving us a call into the studio today. And Delphine works as an advocate for the California Network of Mental Health Clients and has been working for about 5 years. I'm going to see if I can get the technology going here to get Delphine on the air. So, Delphine, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much.
And let's see. I invited you on the show because I really want to really tap into your experience in doing policy work, in doing legislative work, in doing advocacy work for creating a vision of where we'd like the mental health system to go. So I'm really interested in having a discussion about that. And just to start out, why don't you just say a little bit about yourself and your background, how you yourself got into this work?
Okay, well, there was a combination of factors that led me to the work I do now, and I'll explain a little bit more about that in a minute, what the work that I do now, because it's a little bit involved, but where I started from was I was homeless and dealing with having been labeled with several psychiatric disorders, which resulted from my experience of trauma and abuse. And so I had suddenly joined a really large group of people that is unfortunately not as well organized as we will be in the very near future. So I was homeless in the Bay Area of California, where I've lived for 15 years now. And then I was also working, I got active in the social justice movement in a number of different areas, including homeless and housing rights and like food activism, food on bombs, and then also LGBTQ and youth issues and police brutality and prison abolition and supportive prisoners work. So I've been working on all these different issues, and then just by accident, I had a friend who turned out to be working for the local mental health association, and I ended up getting a job there doing tenant advocate work. And for most of the past 7 years, my main source of income has been disability benefits from the federal government, which I'm entitled to because my own labels have resulted in, and the way that society responds to my madness that has led to my labels has made it hard for me to find employment in most of the workforce. So that as a result of that discrimination, we're entitled to benefits, people with what are called mental health disabilities, and I'm one. So anyways, I lived on mostly those plus small stipend for a long time, and then I found out about this one action that was happening in May of 2003 with the group called Mind Freedom, which your listeners may be somewhat familiar with. But for those who haven't heard about it, Mind Freedom is a group, a very large group, a coalition of 1,000 or so different organizations, which represent users and survivors of psychiatry across the world. And Mind Freedom had an action that was a demonstration against the American Psychiatric Association in San Francisco. Mind Freedom is based out of Eugene, Oregon, by the way. But the California Network was involved with that action as well. And we had a good showing of 200-plus people there that day, which was exciting because there was actually a lot of youth there and there was a great deal of diversity, and folks came from all over the country to participate. And I felt like there was an atmosphere of social change and support for people with lived experience in the mental health system that is not often the case with many public events around mental health issues. And so from there, I ended up getting more involved with the California Network of Mental Health Clients. It was my first exposure to the organization. They've been around a while, but outreach is not always something that everyone is knowledgeable about doing. And it's been a learning experience for everyone involved. But I started working with the network about 3 years ago and doing what's called, coordinating the Bay Area Regional Self-Help Project, which means we actually have five regions throughout our state of California. California is a huge state with like 1/7 of the world's economy. And we have quite a few like folks in the mental health system here as well. There's about 1,500 members statewide, and 300 of them or so live in the Bay Area region, which is 13 counties. And we have a regional project that we do each year that's selected by those members. We meet on a semi-monthly basis, and my job is then to pull these meetings together and to try to do the outreach and organizational support that is needed for us to come together and decide on what changes we want to see within the mental health system.
Now, when we think of statewide mental health advocacy organizing, the main group that we tend to think of is NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. But what makes the California Network of Mental Health Clients different is that it's really run by the people who are affected by the system itself, the people who are labeled. And I think you guys are pretty much one of the most progressive statewide client organizations in the country, doing a lot of really innovative and progressive work.
Thank you. It is true. There are not many statewide organizations of by and for mental health clients. And NAMI sometimes represents itself as a group by and for mental health clients, but I would argue that's inaccurate. And here in California, we do have a very active state NAMI and with local chapters. And there are some mental health clients who are involved, but the group is led by a particular group of family members, mostly parents of adults, who have been in the mental health system for years or decades.
Yes, and it also gets funding from the pharmaceutical companies as well. Yeah.
They do receive funding from the pharmaceutical companies, and that's another difference between the two organizations, which is that the California Network we're a member-based organization that does not receive funding from pharmaceuticals.
So how else are you guys distinguished from the more mainstream NAMI approach?
Well, in terms of our philosophies, we agree on some issues, thankfully, but we definitely disagree on others. And let me talk about the positive areas of coalition first. Here in California, we have been working on a huge project called the Mental Health Services Act, which started as a ballot measure in 2004, which ended up winning, passing the state ballot in November of that year. And what it does is it taxes millionaires. 1% of their tax goes into this pot of money that is supposed to fund voluntary client and supposedly client and family-driven services that are community-based, culturally and linguistically competent, and based on a recovery model. And the idea is transformation. The word is repeated throughout every Mental Health Services Act meeting and event. And there have been quite a few of those in the last year and a half, 2 years that we've been working on it.
And we're talking about an enormous amount of money, right?
Yes. And, I mean, it's still a fairly small fraction of the total mental health budget for our state, but it's significant enough that everybody's fighting for it, fighting over it, over that little pot of money. And the county mental health departments have definitely got their work cut out for them, but there's already been a pattern of exclusion towards consumers on the local and state level that we've had to combat over and over again, and that's why the California Network just started our client involvement project. Our Mental Health Services Act Client Involvement Project is designed to make people with lived experience in the mental health system to make a place for us at the table, and to empower people to have a voice in decision-making on all levels.
And you mentioned that this was...
From planning to implementation to evaluation of programs.
You mentioned this was one of the areas where you have a convergence or a coalition with the more mainstream
NAMI groups.
Yes, because NAMI
agreed with us that the Mental Health Services Act was important, and we supported each other in making a lot of the wording of the act itself. And that collaboration is can be seen throughout the act. But at the same time, there's differences too. And there are members of NAMI, maybe not the entire organization, but the leaders of the organizations have endorsed the idea repeatedly that some of this money from Mental Health Services Act should go towards involuntary treatment. And this is an area that the California Network has had a lot of differences and found ourselves on opposite sides of the table from NAMI. And we've had to battle NAMI members and, NAMI California on the state level with regard to a recent outpatient commitment bill that would renew soon to expire a law called Laura's Law, modeled on New York State's Kendra's Law, that would allow counties to opt in to an involuntary commitment, outpatient commitment program that they would fund themselves.
Now, can you explain, because people may not know what involuntary outpatient commitment is, can you just explain a little bit about that? Because I know it's a huge issue in the world of mental health, and a huge issue for the survivor movement.
The idea is it's designed so that adults 18 and over would who are seen as being with a number of other criteria that are both ambiguous and numerous. This group of people who are mostly in reality low income and homeless, living in board and cares, could be subjected to court ordered treatment in a community setting. And by treatment, I mean any type of mental health program that a judge might order in a particular county. And the treatment would be delivered by a multidisciplinary treatment team. And if the person who was subjected to this court order refused the order and said, "I don't want this treatment," they could be sent to the hospital and in an inpatient commitment, which is more familiar probably to most of the listeners.
And in terms of treatment, we're talking about therapy programs, but also drugging, is that right?
Yes, the treatment can include drugging, and it may even include other forms of treatment. There's no exclusion for, say, electroshock or even psychosurgery, but, of course, that's not mentioned by the proponents. And the proponents generally say that this is a medically necessary intervention. They argue that there is a brain disease that means that those of us who are so afflicted are not able, when we are in the throes of a severe incident or an acute onset of our symptoms, we lack insight into our illness. And this is where the California Network strongly disagrees with NAMI. While there are those within the California Network who do believe in the medical model of causation, that there's some biochemical imbalance, not all of us agree on that. And the California Network doesn't have a position on that particular statement. But what we have is an opposition by our whole network to outpatient commitment. And so we have opposed it on the state level, and we've also sued the County of Los Angeles because there was a program there which claimed publicly to be the only Lohr's Law program in the state several years ago. And in a settlement of that lawsuit, Los Angeles County and that program disavowed it being a Lohr's Law program. However, it's that has been brought back into the public. It's been brought in back into the news and into the Senate and Assembly on the state level by proponents of a forced outpatient commitment who are claiming that it was a success here in California and that it was a success in New York State. And we've had to show in so many ways that, A, it has not been tried in California, and, B, in New York State it has been anything but a success. One of the problems in New York State has been that people who are court-ordered are by far disproportionately people of color. As according to a study by the New York Lawyers for the Public Interest, which showed that people of color were mostly African-American and Latino people were disproportionately given court orders to receive treatment. And there's all kinds of reasons, excuses for that situation that proponents of Kendra's Law have argued, such as, well, this happens mostly in New York City, and what do you expect? But when it comes down to it, there really is no excuse for that type of disproportionate enforcement, and it's not that surprising considering the fact that people of color in California are also disproportionately subject to involuntary mental health treatment.
Yeah, it's like
even compared to their white counterparts.
Yeah, it's like the criminal justice system. The force comes down harder on across racial lines, of course, class lines as well. I think we should back up and say the Kendra's Law in New York was named after a woman, a very horrible tragedy of a woman who was pushed off of a subway platform and killed by a man who had a diagnosis, I believe, of schizophrenia. And I really think that this is really the heart of this issue, is that it's people feel overwhelmed, they feel frightened, they have this image of that is fueled by the media and schizophrenia and psychosis as being violent and dangerous. And so there's this quick fix, kind of like, let's use force. And there has not been any study showing that forcing people into outpatient treatment is actually effective for making them get better. And there is no, the studies have consistently shown that people with mental health diagnoses are not only not more violent than the rest of the society, but actually much more likely to be victims of violence. So you really have a legislation here that's being fueled by fear and discrimination and not by sound health policy. And I think it's because it got through in New York that they're trying to pursue this in California. But who is the Laura of Laura's Law? Do you know that? Or?
Well, yes. In California, we have a similar story that precipitated our law. And it seems that there has been a trend of this type of thing. But here in California, as in other states, there was one incident that reached the ears of the Treatment Advocacy Center, and I'll describe them in a moment. But the incident happened in 1999, and a man who was psychiatrically labeled and who was trying to be seen for, he was undergoing mental health services at the time, and he was trying to be seen for an appointment, but he was being told that he could not be seen that day by an intern at his local mental health clinic. And this happened in the rural Nevada County, which is on the east of the state. And he had a gun on him, and he was on a shooting spree that day, and he shot and killed the receptionist, whose name was Laura Wilcox, and she was a college student. She was 19 years old. He also killed two other people that day, and then he was captured and locked up, and he's been in Napa State Hospital ever since. But Laura's parents were soon approached by a group called the Treatment Advocacy Center, which has been going around to all the states and trying to get laws passed, mostly succeeding in getting laws passed that require this hospital without walls, this outpatient commitment. And they saw that California didn't have one of those laws on the books in 99, and as a continuation of another project, they pushed this in 2001. And after several other attempts to change our inpatient commitment law and broaden the criteria of those failed, also driven by the Treatment Advocacy Center, now attaching Laura's name and face to this new law seemed to propel it through the state legislature much more successfully. And still, there was opposition from some of the senators who were much more closely in touch with the advocates from the California Network and from the client and survivor movement, the movement of people who use services in the mental health system or who have been involuntarily detained in the system. And they put some what we call poison pills into the law, which made it much harder to implement, and basically they have not implemented it up until now because each county would have to fund it themselves rather than have the money come from the state. But that is one of the primary points of contention now with the new law that would extend the sunset by 5 years. Initially, the law would have also made the law permanent. The new bill, AB 2357, would have made the law permanent, but in an amendment early on, that it was changed to a five-year extension as a compromise because there was heavy opposition from our movement. But right now, that bill has passed both our state Senate and Assembly, and it did so with supermajority votes. In spite of the fact that we went around and spoke to each legislator or each legislator's representative prior to their votes, and we mounted a letter-writing campaign for both the Assembly and the Senate, still there seemed to be a major momentum within the both parties in state government to do this. Republicans were split in the Senate, but pretty much the Democrats all got behind it, except for a couple of folks. And the Republicans mostly did too. So it was very unfortunate, but now we have it sitting on the governor's desk, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, and we're hoping that he will veto it. We've also done another letter-writing campaign to try to stop it there.
So we're
not very hopeful.
Well, just to take a devil's advocate position, I mean, you have people who are clearly, I mean, you mentioned madness before, and I think that we would both agree that these are real experiences that people are definitely, I mean, I've been through them, and it sounds like you've been through them, going through really extreme states of consciousness and having a very, very difficult time. And so just to take a devil's advocate position, you know, what are we going to do about folks who may be a danger to other people, or maybe suicidal, or maybe, you know, ready to go on a shooting spree, or go on a, you know, push someone off of a subway platform? And I think both of us are very aware. I mean, I don't know the actual details. I have not been following it.
No, thank you for bringing that up. That's a very important question.
Yeah, but we're both aware of the psychiatrist who was killed in Maryland a few days ago by his 19-year-old. So this is a very prominent schizophrenia researcher, and I think that we're both concerned that this is, you know, going to be, again, raising a clamor of, well, let's just lock people up, let's just pass outpatient commitment. That's the only way to kind of deal with these so-called dangerous mental patients. So what would you say to that?
Well, I am also very concerned that this may be used against us as other isolated incidents have. And I think first and foremost, we need to remember that studies have shown that people who are diagnosed and labeled with mental illness are not any more likely to be violent than the general public, unless they are using drugs and alcohol. And also, even in those cases, I think it's not fair to make assumptions. Stereotypes are stereotypes. Everybody, I think we need to recognize that the process of diagnosis and labeling is extremely biased, both culturally and in terms of ideology, with an allopathic Western medicine approach taking precedence over traditional indigenous cultures and communities of color who have their own ideas of wellness and well-being, and also other modalities of healing, such as harm reduction, are often thrown out the window by a model that has long depended on the idea of medication compliance and maintenance as its primary and usually its only form of treatment. And at the California Network, we support the concept of self-help. It's not just a concept. The idea is that we, the people who have experienced mental health issues and or who have been labeled as mentally ill, are the ones who can and do provide meaningful support to each other in many ways. And just the types of services that you guys offer there at the Freedom Center, which your listeners heard at the beginning of this program, are a great example. We also have similar programs here in California, although not quite as comprehensive in the Bay Area, I should say. We're rather jealous, and we would love to do more of the kinds of work that you do there, as well as there's a program in New Hampshire that we consider to be a model that is called Stepping Stone, and it is a peer-run place where people can go when they are experiencing extreme emotional distress and they want to avoid being hospitalized, and they will be cared for by other people with similar experiences. So we really like those programs, and we are actively promoting them on our state level as transformational alternatives that could be funded under the Mental Health Services Act.
Yeah, that's one of the things that people need to know about the example in Kendra's law, the woman Kendra who was killed on the subway platform, the man who pushed her off of the subway platform, if you actually found out a little bit more about who he was actually looking for help. He had gone to a number of mental health programs and was trying to get some support and find some services, but he had been turned away. So I think it's really an example of, you know, you really need to provide voluntary services to people if you want to avoid these kind of desperate crises that people end up getting into.
Absolutely. And so the medical model, unfortunately, has been based on a crisis model as well. And in California, we call it the fail-first model. And really, who's failed when people's first access point and their only access point to the mental health system is through the psych emergency ward and what they call a 5150 here, an involuntary commitment.
It's called a Section 12. Section 12 in Massachusetts.
Right. Everyone's got their own numbers cluttered.
Yeah.
But that type of approach is really outdated and really discriminatory. There's really no other part of medicine where people are involuntarily detained when they are asking for help. And in the same way that it happens in mental health, with the possible exception of acute cases of tuberculosis. So I would say that we need to really look at that and start working on client-run alternatives that involve prevention, early intervention. And I should say there are a lot of different terms that we use to describe ourselves. We don't all agree on what they are, and some of us, I identify as both a client and a survivor because I still try to find services that help me, and not all of them are necessarily available from people who have had similar experiences to my own where I live. So I sometimes seek out talk therapy with counselors who don't self-identify as being people with lived experience in the mental health system. But I'm also a survivor of abuse within the system. And I wanted to talk about what we learned in our focus groups on discrimination and stigma, because in the Bay Area region, we have made it our project to develop a client survivor message on discrimination and stigma, and we developed a set of questions that we took around to 12 different settings, and we held focus groups with people of lived experience in the mental health system in settings varying from client survivor-run self-help centers to hospitals, locked hospital wards, a board and care facility, and a number of drop-in centers for youth, and also an email list and a youth advisory task force. So we asked folks of many different ages and experiences how they experience discrimination and from which groups, and also what did they feel was most useful in changing that. And many folks spoke directly of their experience getting forced to participate in treatment programs, usually medication. And they said that this was a traumatizing experience, that this was the experience that represented discrimination and stigma to them, and that the whole approach of the system to people who use it needs to change. And people should be able to participate in a voluntary way that includes self-direction and in dignity, and where people have alternatives and choices. And that's what the California Network believes in. So this really underscored our work, and we plan to go public with it as soon as we complete our recommendations. We actually do have a website up currently, and I'll say the URL for your listeners.
Yeah, please do.
This website is kind of temporary, and we're going to put up something better soon. But right now, if you go to http://, no WWs needed, go to strategiesforchange.org, all one word, .googlepages.com. Again, strategies for change, all one word, .googlepages.com. And the word for and strategies for change is spelled out F-O-R. So if you go there, you'll see the website for the Bay Area Regional Self-Help Project. You can also Google that if you can remember all that.
Okay.
And sorry it's so long. But anyway, that there we have talked about the research. And what people revealed when they talked about their experience of discrimination was that the mental health system is among the leaders of perpetrating and perpetuating stigma and discrimination, that would receive the most complaints of all the different sources people cited. It was followed by community and society, and then family members, and then the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there actually was a study that was done that compared mental health professionals to the general population in terms of their attitudes towards people labeled with mental illness. And in fact, the attitudes were worse and more discriminatory among mental health professionals than they were among the mainstream public, which says a lot about what people are learning in school and how the whole system is set up. Delphine, you mentioned something earlier that I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned, you know, having experiencing madness and having this be something that makes it difficult, you know, to find a work in society, and then being on a disability check.
Yeah.
How would you, you know, respond to someone who says, "Well, if you don't believe that it's a physical disease, and you don't believe that you are, inferior or genetically somehow impaired or biochemically, you know, sick, then what is the justification for getting a disability check?"
Thank you. Good question. Let me speak to that a bit. I feel that we have differences, there's no doubt, and I do experience things that are different than other folks, although who gets labeled as mentally ill is, I think, definitely subject to cultural assumptions based on cultural norms, and I think that people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans, for one, are more likely to be labeled, even though not all of our genders and sexual orientations are necessarily in the DSM-4 these days. Trans people still are.
Right, there's gender identity disorder and.
Transgender people are still listed as gender identity disorder, which is still in the DSM-4.
And I think that there's also transvestite fetishism or something.
Right.
There's some different.
Yeah, there's a number of different ways that trans people are listed.
Yeah.
So, and the different groups of trans people are listed as being mentally disordered. But also, people who've survived trauma and experience what is called post-traumatic stress disorder are also labeled. People who experience what is called depression and other mood disorders, such as bipolar. I mean, many of you have probably heard the laundry list of disorders that the DSM-4 uses. The more commonly known ones that are in the news a lot, and many of us have them labeled, and yet we don't always agree with the medical diagnosis that this is a biochemical disease, but it's undeniable that we do have some differences that people can see about us, and that unfortunately we face discrimination for when they become apparent to our employers or our landlords or to our families, and it's at those times when we are most in need of support that the discrimination is most likely to happen.
Yeah.
If any of us have, when we do get hospitalized, which happens to quite a few of us, that works as this huge strike against us, because not only is there the punitive forced treatment aspect where we are deprived of our civil liberties and either locked up or forced to receive treatment in a community setting. There's also the long-term ramifications of that forced treatment, where it's on our permanent medical record. The record follows us everywhere we go, and computer systems, and we don't have access to it necessarily. Rumors circulate about us in the community, in our workplace, and in our families, and we get ostracized and we get cut off, and ultimately our records are as much or more responsible for the discrimination that, I mean, not responsible, but are used to justify the discrimination that we face as our own behaviors.
Yeah,
so even when I'm not showing what people consider symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, I still have that on my record, and I still receive disability money from SSI and SSDI that shows that I have some kind of disability. When that disability isn't visible, people often make assumptions, well, this must be a crazy person.
Right. Yeah, there have been many times when people have contacted the Freedom Center and said, look, how do I get my diagnosis, you know, expunged and erased from my medical record? Because it's kind of like a criminal record. You want to get, you know, there's ways that you can get your criminal record corrected. You can appeal. You can, you know, get record sealed as part of an agreement with the court. But with your psychiatric history, there's no way. Once a doctor has put down in writing somewhere that you are bipolar or schizophrenic, it's there permanently. It's a stain that will just continue to haunt you. And it does work in exactly the way that you're saying.
Absolutely. And that was mentioned in many of the comments that we received in our focus group study. So that is part and parcel of the stigma and discrimination that mental health clients and survivors face every day.
Yeah, and the reality is that people are, once they hear that, oh, someone has been hospitalized or someone has been attempted suicide or someone is on medication or they have a schizophrenia or bipolar, I mean, it's incredible the change that people can go through. They suddenly will not trust you. They will have these assumptions. A lot of their own fears get stirred up, and I think we have a long way to go in society to overcome that. I mean, there's so much in the media just associating psychotic and schizophrenic and mentally ill people with violence, and people just, you know, wouldn't dream of considering like being in a relationship with someone who's got a mental illness or diagnosis or someone who's psychotic, or that these are just unimaginable. And then of course when you meet someone such as yourself or like me, who seem like we're, you know, carrying on a rational conversation, we're showing up, it's like, oh, well, this is not one of those people. These are not, you know, the people that we're talking about are the really seriously crazy ones over there. Whereas reality is, it's not like that. And people go in and out of different states of consciousness. And all of us, we don't have to always be, you know, raving lunatics on the streets to have these labels. The vast majority of people that have these labels, you're not going to be able to look to tell from looking at them from the outside.
Right, and yet these stereotypes are responsible for so much public policy, and this is where the California Network is kept busy, both within the framework of the Mental Health Services Act, where we are advocating always for transformation in the face of so much of the same old that the system wants to fund with this money, and we're hearing proposals for the money. I mean, this could be in the regulations. Some of this money could go to inpatient hospitalization on a short-term basis.
Wow.
Because they consider that to be a part of what will happen when vast numbers of new people enter the mental health system voluntarily through other programs, what they call a full-service partnership. And also, we're having to fight it on a local level with things like the police protocols when people are hospitalized and committed as inpatients. For example, in Berkeley, they just had a historic public hearing there where their mental health commission heard testimony from consumers about abuse they experienced at the hands of police who shouldn't have even been there on the scene because they were not a danger to themselves or others. And so often this happens to folks who are in vulnerable positions socially. They're either homeless or they're living with housemates and they just lost their job, they had an emotional crisis. There's all kinds of reasons why people get in a bad spot, and then automatically, as soon as someone calls 911, the police are called if they suspect the person to have a mental illness.
Yeah, there's no middle ground. It's sort of like it's a huge overreaction. There was a terrible case of someone in Brattleboro several months ago where he was in a very weird state of consciousness. He was not violent. He was not suicidal. He was just going door to door, talking to people, saying that he was running for president. And it was at 11 o'clock at night. So someone called the police on him. This is, you know, New England. We have a very kind of witch hunt. If this happened in New York City, you know, no one would have thought anything of it. But in New England, people tend to overreact when things get a little weird. And the police came, and then we're not sure exactly what happened, but the individual ended up dying. He was, you know, he was freaked out and fled the police and went into a river and died. And this is the kind of thing that happens frequently. It's sort of an overreaction that society has, and it can provoke people because, as you've pointed out, I mean, we do tend to be trauma survivors, and we do get triggered. And once we've had force used against us, anytime someone comes at us with force, it's going to trigger that trauma response, and we're going to react.
Absolutely, and not only that, but there's been quite a few cases of police responding with lethal force on a 5150 call, or a call to respond to a person who is experiencing emotional distress. In San Francisco and San Jose in the last several years, young people of color have been shot and killed by police when they were not even presenting a threat to other people's safety. They were just having an emotional crisis in a public place.
Well, listen, this has been a great conversation. It's always a short, hour. But Delphine Brody, I want to thank you for very much for coming on the show and talking about your advocacy work and experiences out there in California.
Thank you very much, Will, and best of luck to you and the Freedom Center, and thank you for doing this show.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And just to mention again that Delphine talked about a website, which is http://strategiesforchange.googlepages.com. That's strategiesforchange.googlepages.com. And this is the Mental Health Show on Valley Free Radio, and we'll be back next week. Our show is, actually, we have a special guest, Kate Bornstein, is going to be talking about her new book about suicide. So join us next Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Until then, thanks a lot for tuning in.